You're listening to the BRC podcast. My name is Carl Monk, Director of Insight at the British Retail Consortium, and today we'll be discussing retail transformation with Mike Debner, Solution Principal at Medallia. On today's podcast, Mike and I will be asking ourselves what the future holds for the retail sector and what the most substantial shifts are, both in terms of consumer behavior and business practices. I'm very excited to have Mike with us today. He brings a wealth of knowledge in consumer experience and innovation strategy that he's gained from his long and storied career. Prior to Medallia, Mike was at 7-Eleven as Vice President and Co-Founder of 7 Ventures. And he worked on numerous projects from loyalty to digital transformation, all of which were sort of visionary and groundbreaking at the time. So digital transformation and the interplay between physical or brick and mortar retail is nothing new. But the pace of change, the fact that we've seen 5 years of digital transformation in just 5 months this year, which has been forced upon us due to COVID, has led to some really interesting developments. So, I mean, if we start by diving into what's happened to physical retail and then specifically here in the UK, prior to COVID, around 70% of non-food sales, so your clothing, your electricals and similar items were made in store. For many categories, this ratio of online to in-store spend has been completely flipped by COVID. And we've seen sort of consistent online sales growth of around plus 40 since March. My first question to you, Mike, is, you know, what are the key changes that you've seen amongst your clients? And, you know, are these trends that we've seen in the UK representative of what's happening globally?
Hey, thanks, Kyle. I think, you know, we're definitely seeing a macro trend. Here's how I'd categorize that macro trend change is that for the last decade, we have exalted brands. We have put brands on altars that are really, really good at fidelity. And I'm going to use this construct that's in a fantastic book that is by a guy named Kevin Manley. And it's called The Trade-Off. And there's this healthy tension amongst all businesses between fidelity, meaning like the extent of an experience, and convenience. So there's this balance, a healthy tension between this idea of ultimate experience and convenience. And what we've seen is over the last decade, like I said, that brands that are all about fidelity have really been ruled the roost. You know, they have been the ones that have catapulted in the stock market. They're the ones that have all the great stories around. And that's been great. And they've capitalized on this ultimate experience. Well, then comes, 2020, and the experience is still important, but what's now trumped experience is convenience. And so now we're seeing that brands are having to quickly understand convenience. And at the same time, they're trying to really hold on to their experience. So let's take a high-end restaurant that is all about fidelity, right? It's all about how you're greeted, the ambiance, the aesthetic, the service that you're given, everything, even down to the crowd, like what crowd is in there? Are you amongst, you know, the hip crowd and all these types of things? It's all about fidelity and experience. And now maybe they're restricted to 25% occupancy. And to make up the gap, they're having to go and switch over to the convenience side of things and do something like order online and pick up in store. So you could see how that would be very disruptive in a bad way to a brand that has a lot of fidelity and a lot of experience going for it. So that's what we've really seen is that the players that were already great at convenience are reaping the benefits of 2020 and, you know, and going through the pandemic. They are actually doing very well. They're not missing a beat. It's the ones that are having to adapt convenience that are really having to do that. I like what you said, like 5 years and 5 months. It's tomorrow today. And so I think that's the main driver. And what we're seeing from our clients are they're doing it quickly. They're getting feedback from their customers about how they're doing. And by the way, the feedback is pretty interesting. So if you take a metric like NPS, like a likelihood to recommend, we actually didn't see that much of a dip in that metric. So in other words, customers are still giving high marks and they're having empathy. We saw empathy in the comments, meaning that they have empathy for employees that are having to work through this, empathy for employees that that are overburdened we hear a lot of stories about, even on the digital side with Amazon, with, you know, just being crushed and employees working 14-hour days. So I love this about human beings and our species, is that we do realize that there are people that are on the front lines and are doing the extra work to keep our lives as normal as possible. So we saw a lot of empathy at first. Now that's waning, because customers now are expecting, hey, you've been at this for 8 months, you got to get better. We can't take out of stocks. We can't take experiences that aren't, that haven't been thoughtfully crafted. And, you know, now game on. Now the whoever can bring that back into reality, let's say, like whoever could get there first is going to have a disproportionate advantage with customers, because now the expectation is that you've been at this long enough, so you should get back closer to normal.
And I guess building on that convenience piece, so I mean, convenience previously was, you know, sort of locality, it was speed. I guess, you know, there's a lot of forced impositions now on retail businesses and restaurants. So, you know, they might have limited capacity, they might have, you know, sort of requirements for sanitation, things that sort of add friction to physical retail. And I guess naturally that means that people would go online, because it's a lot less friction filled than some of these physical options. What are some ways that sort of physical retailers are mitigating or making the best of the current situation?
Yeah. You know, I love your question around, well, what are the attributes of convenience? Because you might be listening to this podcast and say, well, what does it mean to be convenient? And, you know, I've studied convenience my whole life. You know, as a young kid, I know this sounds kind of funny, but, you know, I told my parents I always wanted to work for 7-Eleven, a convenience store. I thought it was the coolest store on the planet. I'm talking like I'm 5 years old, you know? And you know, luckily I made that happen, and I went to work for the company that invented convenience. Now, let's talk about the invention of convenience, because 7-Eleven really did invent it. And it's a longer story that we could tell at another time. But basically what they did is 7-Eleven started as an ice company. They sold blocks of ice that went into an ice box to keep food fresh. And they had these ice docks everywhere. And what happened was, is that they either delivered ice to your house to put in, you know, in this ice box, or you went to the ice dock and picked it up yourself. Now, we're talking about back in the time of horse and buggy, although the Model T had been invented by then. And so what happened was, fast forward, and the refrigerator was invented. So it kind of disrupted the ice business, right? But what 7-Eleven did was they realized that they had all these small format ice docks that they could start selling other things from. And they started selling goods from there, and they were open all the time, because ice docks had to be open all the time. And what they started doing is selling a lot of things like milk, bread, and eggs. And inadvertently, they invented the convenience store. Later on, they went on to the first company to really remain open 24 hours a day, convenience. So long story short is, what is convenience? At its core, convenience is just access. It's access to a product or a good or a service. And so when you think about access, you think about, okay, well, that means that it's local, that there's access to an assortment of goods that I need and that are available. And also, one of the biggest attributes of convenience, and people don't think about this, Manley covers this in his book, The Trade-Off, is maybe the number one attribute of convenience is price. Well, if it's out of range of price, well, then it's clearly inconvenient for you. So as we see the shift to convenience, the shift to access, we see that companies are starting to use digital as the beginning of the transaction, right? So when you think about digital as the beginning of the transaction, you think about that your discovery, right? Discovery of goods and services that you need, selection. So I'm down selecting into what exactly I need. Well, you better be very good at search when it comes to digital. You be very good at design, as far as making it easy to find the right product digitally. When I'm out in a store and I'm searching a shelf, you know, that's a different story. But when I'm in a digital, you've got to be that simple, toaster simple about finding product. And so you got the discovery and selection, And then maybe even, you know, kind of the cart where I put something in, maybe I'm paying for it then, or I'm going to pay for it when I pick up. And so then you've got to go to the actual brick and mortar or physical experience to complete that transaction. Let's just call it the, you know, the last mile of that transaction. And so you got to be convenient across all of these things, convenient about selection, convenient about payment, convenient about location. Is a location close enough to me? Convenient about the delivery experience. And then even convenient about, well, for example, in the restaurant experience, you know, instead of sitting down at a restaurant at a table with the ketchup and the salt and the pepper and the napkins and the forks and the utensils, now I've got to make, I got to like build all that into the experience so that when somebody actually arrives at home or wherever at work where they're going to have this meal, that all of that is available to them, that it's all convenient. They don't have to go run off for napkins or utensils or condiments, that it's all built in to that experience. So to me, that's the big lesson. And it kind of goes to, you know, the physical experience here. So if I start something digitally online and I'm going to fulfill it in a physical experience, well, let me ask you, like, how have these brands prepared for this? You know, have they trained employees? Are there specialties within the employee ranks that know how to do these things? And the answer has pretty much been no. Now, if you've already been in this convenience, you know, lane, let's say, for example, I think 7-Eleven is convenient, obviously, for a lot of reasons, but look at the advent of the drive-thru. Largely, McDonald's is credited with this. I mean, there was some smaller players. There was a company called The Pig Out in Texas that had a drive-thru, a small player. But McDonald's institutionalized this, and it came from Arizona, a franchisee in Arizona that literally knocked the bricks out of the side of the wall and put a window in and invented the drive-thru. Well, the drive-thrus had 40 years or 50 years to perfect. And, you know, and it took that long to perfect. We don't have that kind of time to perfect convenience anymore. So we don't have 40 or 50 years to perfect it. We got to do it much quicker. Luckily, we can do it much quicker because we can iterate quickly on convenience. We can iterate quickly on something like order online, pick up at curb or delivery, because we have the digital data and we have the access, once again, to the customer to actually understand their feedback about the experience, take that feedback into account, and then iterate on that and make and tighten up the experience very quickly. You know, for example, you go back in history and you say, well, how did brands iterate on their ideas, say 40 or 50 years ago? Well, I know exactly how they did it because my grandmother was a huge participant in customer experience in her day. She had something to say about every experience. Well, how did she inform brands? I can tell you because I saw her do it, is that she sat down and wrote letters to the brands about her experience. She took the letter, she folded it up, put it in an envelope, put a stamp on it, found an address. Without the internet, how do you even find an address for a company? She found an address, took it to a post office box at the end of the block, threw it into the box and said, God, I hope somebody reads that. You know what? And a lot of people did. It's much easier now for customers to give brands feedback, but there's an expectation. The expectation is that they do something about the feedback and that they're transparent about the actions they're taking against the feedback. So I'm a huge optimist that, you know, Kyle, to your point, 5 years and 5 months, we can pull it off.
It's nice to have an optimistic viewpoint in the sea of doom and gloom that you sometimes see or could be fooled but into seeing by looking at the papers. But I think that's a good segue. So, I mean, I think we've covered off how physical experience of changes, the limitations, the challenges, the sort of drive towards convenience that's driven a lot of the change in those locations over the last year. But I guess looking towards digital, and you mentioned, I guess, how it's helped inform feedback and drive change that way. But I mean, in terms of digital as a channel, so what have you seen? You know, we've seen huge growth here in the UK, and I've got no doubt that that's the case in many sort of Western countries. But I guess every company is at a different stage of digital growth. So some, you know, you've got your pure players who've been honing their craft and who've been operating very well just in a distribution and online model for the last however many years. And you've got some of the larger legacy retailers, if you can call them that, who perhaps are slightly further behind in their journeys. So what have you seen in terms of, you know, differences in operational readiness, you know, success stories? Give us some insights into that.
Absolutely. Digital is nothing new. Or I would say the digital transformation started in earnest 6-7 years ago. And you know, kind of every brand had to jump in. And they, you know, at first it was more informational, right? I mean, a digital channel was informational. What goods and services do we offer? Where is our location? Here's some deals and some offers. And it quickly moved from informational to transactional. And so a transactional would be, okay, not only here are the goods and services that I offer, but you can actually complete the transaction and we'll fulfill the transaction for you. And so I'd say that specifically, example, retail, and retail drives the world's economy. I mean, there's no doubt about that. That in retail, it was all around e-commerce, right? So e-commerce was this siloed channel that people built alongside of their legacy channel, which was their core business model, which, you know, a lot of times was, well, most times was a physical experience, a brick and mortar experience. So they built them side by side and they had to go quick. So there wasn't a lot of this, there wasn't a lot of really good integration between the two. And so that was perfected, you know, and it was painful. I went through that. I'm sure a lot of people that are listening went through that integration of, you know, let's have an e-commerce channel that is integrated with our physical channel. And we saw things like being able to, you know, look up inventory in store, to be able to order something online and have it fulfilled from a distribution center or fulfilled from a store, if that's where the product was. And the ability to pick, pack, and ship from stores. And that was hard. It's hard to train employees to prioritize that. What we're seeing now is that it's a whole new level, which is, it's not just fulfilling from a distribution center through UPS or FedEx or some other parcel, that now it's a delivery model. So I order something and I want it delivered, the ultimate convenience. And here's my first point. There's my like my headline here. I've got a few headlines. The headline here is own the experience. We've worked with a lot of brands that they said, hey, we can't build a delivery network. We're not experts at that. That's very expensive. So they've used third parties to do the delivery. The last mile of the experience, the last taste of the experience, right? The recency of the experience has been potentially a startup that doesn't have very good for reasons that are absolutely right, but they don't have a lot of, you know, hardened processes and that type of thing because they're a startup. So the brand has owned everything up until the delivery. And now the delivery, they just basically hand off to a startup and they kind of do the ceremonial cross themselves and say, I hope it goes well. No, you can't do that anymore. When it was a niche play, when it was 1% of your revenue, you could probably do that. Now, maybe it's 40, 50, 60% of your revenue. You have to own the experience. So that's the thing I would do is figure out either how you're going to brand that experience, you know, get rid of the Postmates, get rid of the third party brand and just own the experience from A to Z and then be accountable for following up and making it right when things don't go so well. So own the experience from beginning to end, even if you're using a third party for delivery. So that's one thing that I would say is that, you know, you just, even though you can't afford to build the network, you could still be responsible and accountable for the whole journey, if you will, of the customer. What I love about the, once again, a historian here, this is a throwback. So I remember a company in the late 1990s that was way ahead of its time. And the company was called Cosmo.com. And they were a delivery company and people loved it. They started in New York City and they delivered, you know, everything and anything that was convenient they delivered movies and ice cream and Snickers bars and, you know, whatever you needed as a New Yorker. And they delivered that for free. And what they did was they built out their own distribution centers, and they had couriers running around the streets on bicycles and foot and other, and delivering these products. And they had the, it was right, but they were right. They were well before their time, and they owned the full experience. They had the customer contact center that if you got the wrong product, you know, you called them, you got it right. Their discovery and selection was all on the web, believe it or not, in the late 1990s. And they kind of had the right idea. So if we could just go back to executing the way that they executed 20 years ago and learn from the past, I think we'd be in good shape. So that's where I would go on the digital side is we're seeing, like I said, a lot of this shift to delivery and curbside. And a lot of these brands just aren't experienced at it, but you've got to get experience quickly. And the way I, once again, the one way I would do that is just open yourself up. Get out there and do it, but open yourself up for feedback and take that feedback and take action on the feedback and then be transparent with your customers about what you're doing. So you'll get the empathy. You'll get the benefit of the doubt if they know, yes, this is new for you, but you're doing your best and you're being transparent about your weaknesses and your strengths.
That's a good steer there. So, I mean, we've definitely seen that anecdotally in the UK. So the whole sort of fail fast, fail small philosophy. So people's innovation life cycles have definitely shortened over the last 5 months. I think that that last mile piece and owning the last mile out of necessity has actually become part of the norm for a lot of people in the UK through brands operating dark stores. You know, during lockdown, one of the only ways that stores could continue trading was through click and collect, which is, I guess, our sort of version of curbside, if you want, in the UK, seeing as we drive a little bit less here, although some brands like Dixon's were in the early days. I think they were one of the pioneers. They offered boot delivery in their retail park locations. But you're right, it's controlling that. You know, no one wants a sort of delivery service during their parcel wherever. And if that's the last thing that you remember of a retail experience, then you're not going to be necessarily inclined to shop at those locations in the future. I guess that sort of takes us quite neatly onto sort of the merger of the two. So what we've seen more in recent years is, I don't like the term omnichannel. I think it's outplayed. You're right. I think it's a product of how companies used to work and how they used to work in the wrong way. So treating physical retail, digital retail as two separate entities, usually with two different teams and without the sort of communication between the two that there should be. But that is changing slowly but surely. There are still, I was speaking to a retailer recently, who still counted returns to physical stores that were purchased online against that store's individual target, which I thought that most brands had done away with. But it turns out that, you know, as we were discussing earlier, not everyone is as far along that digital transformation journey as perhaps they should be. But a lot of brands are getting it right. Increasingly, there's been a lot of success stories about people and businesses coming a long way in the last 5 months in their digital journeys and actually really reaping the rewards of having an interconnected digital journey. So both raising the visibility of stock in store. So, you know, we're a lot more cautious than we used to be. Shopper missions have changed. They've become more focused. We don't have the same sort of social and discovery shopper missions that we used to quite to the same extent due to limitations imposed by COVID. So it's more crucial than ever to essentially highlight and give confidence to consumers that when they're coming to a store that they know the items that they want will be there. So surfacing stock digitally through websites or via channels like Google and other search engines is one way they can do that. But equally using apps to capitalize on that discovery piece that's being done digitally now, and then allowing the fulfillment to happen at a physical location via click and collect is also increasingly popular. And we definitely saw over the Christmas period that some weeks, you know, online sales, I said that the average this year was around 40%, but we saw it sort of spike up to 70% in some weeks as people who were obviously in tier three and tier four were utilizing click and collect to an extent that they hadn't in previous years. So I guess this brings us on to, you know, our final piece. And you touched on curbside, I've touched on sort of click and collect, but, you know, what's at stake now? You know, what in this new future where brands are getting it right and they're merging the physical and digital experiences, what are some of the sort of key lessons and sort of key trends that people can take forward into 2021 to help capitalize on this this new normal?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, one thing I want to touch on, Kyle, is, you know, you've got the stats. We're seeing a monumental change in consumer behavior and how they're engaging with brands. And one of the questions I get all the time is, you know, as if I'm some sort of, can read a crystal ball, is this going to stick? All this shift to transactions being online and delivery and click and collect and the like, is that going to stick? Or is it going to, is it going to go more back to normal? And I don't have the answer to that, but I've got examples that I think that you'll find interesting of how convenience is a trump card, how convenience sticks. Okay. So the first example is, I brought it up earlier, is for example, with drive-through. If you look at a quick service restaurant or fast food restaurant, you know, once drive-through was invented and created, now somewhere between 60 and 70% of the revenue comes through the drive-thru. That genie ain't going back in the bottle. That's permanent, right? So you go, ooh, well, drive-thru is, it's kind of a proxy for click and collect, right? I mean, it's basically the same thing. So is the click and collect or the curbside going to stick? My answer to that is, can't put the genie back in the bottle. Look at drive-thru from a convenience standpoint, and it's stuck and it drives most of the profits or most of the revenue for something like quick service or fast food. So that's number one. Look at delivery as a convenience. When I was a kid, when our family went, when we wanted to eat pizza, we went to a restaurant and sat down and ate pizza. Nobody does that anymore. Delivery is the predominant business model. Once that convenience came out of the genie bottle, it never went back in. So I want you to think about that. Like, those are the predominant ways. The convenience is the predominant way to interact with those types of brands. Will that spread to other businesses and other brands? My answer is, look at history, probably will. So what do you do about this, right? And so this is the problem, and we need to get pragmatic about it. So I have three things to meld and mesh the physical and digital together, all right? There's three things you got to worry about. There's three things that you got to focus on. There's three things that you've got to put resource against. The first one is obvious, and that's technology. And as we've already talked about, I don't know a brand or a leader, CEO of a brand that doesn't have a huge budget for technology. And if they don't have a huge budget for technology, they're probably not going to be the CEO very long. So technology is obvious. Honestly, it's probably the easiest part. You know, it's ones and zeros, it's binary. You could create the technology, the underpinnings of this new business model, this omni business model, and that's the ground floor. That's table stakes. But as we all know, you could put technology in people's hands and it could fail. It could be great technology and it still fail. So that brings me to point number two, and that's operations. Is that don't overlook operations. How is technology going to change we used to call it the happy day flow, right? The happy day flow of your business. How is technology going to impact that on a human level? So you got to think about operations. How am I going to operate this business? For example, that dude in Arizona at that first McDonald's knocked all those bricks out of the wall and put a window in there, right? And then they said, well, how are we going to do this operationally? They added headsets. They added a second line for food prep and drink prep. They added another window just to take payment. They added two lanes. Now there's two lanes at a lot. So what I'm saying here is that operationally, you have to catch up with the technology as it becomes adopted. And you have to have a plan for that. Number three, and Kyle, you brought it up, is that's incentives. This is a lot of extra work. How are you going to motivate? And how are you going to give incentives that the business models will be co-prosperity in the business models, that the digital and the physical are leading to serving customers, and that everybody's successful if you're successful at serving customers. So those would be the three things. The technology, don't let technology outstrip operations, and then take care of your employees, give them the right incentives. They don't need to be monetary incentives, right? I love this body of work by Daniel Pink. He wrote this book called Drive, What Really Motivates People. And there's intrinsic motivation, which is, I just feel like I belong, like my voice is heard. Employees love to be heard. hey, I see something that we can improve on. Will somebody listen to me? That's intrinsic motivation if somebody actually does listen to them. Extrinsic motivation is things like money. And money doesn't, it's not a long-term motivator. So think about how you intrinsically incentivize your employees to fulfill your vision, your business model, and the convenience for the customer into the future. That's the three things that I would focus on.
All good points, Mike. And I think our listeners will do well to adopt those in their strategies in the coming year. I think that's it for our time today. But I just want to thank you, Mike, for sharing your insights with our listeners. And for our listeners, any information on any of the topics covered today or to find out more about how Medallia can help you with your business, please check out the show notes. We'll have links in there on how to get in touch. To hear anything more about the BRC or to get in touch with me, the show notes are also the place to go. So thank you very much and have an excellent day.